Hi, everyone. It's Belinda Ellsworth, and I want to thank you so much for listening to Work From Your Happy Place. We're very excited today to be celebrating our 300th episode, and I couldn't be more thrilled than to be celebrating this with one of the most inspiring interviews that I've done so far since I began the podcast a few years ago. Amy Downs is an Oklahoma City bombing survivor, and her story is incredible and unbelievable, but what she's done with her life since then is awe-inspiring. I know that you are going to leave this interview being inspired just as I was. In helping us to celebrate and continue to move our program forward as we head toward 400 and even 500 episodes, if you could please share this with a friend and help us to continue to bring great quality interviews to our listeners, we so appreciate it. Hope you enjoy this 300th episode and leave inspired as I was.
Welcome to Work From Your Happy Place, the podcast that equips you with the tools, know-how, and motivation to live your dreams and find your happy place. Be sure to sign up for our free weekly newsletter for a recap of the week's guests and a preview of what's in store. To sign up, simply text the word happy place with no space to 33444. Now, it's my pleasure to introduce the host of Work From Your Happy Place, Belinda Ellsworth.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Work From Your Happy Place. I have to tell you, I'm so excited about our guest today. I have Amy Downs with me, and I heard Amy on another podcast, and I was so inspired that I reached out to the people that work with her and said, we want to get her on our show. So I am very excited to be able to share this space with her today and to share her story with all of you. So Amy Downs is a CEO of Allegiance Credit Union, formerly Federal Employees Credit Union in Oklahoma City, which lost more than half of its employees in the Oklahoma City bombing in 1995, the deadliest domestic terror attack in our nation's history. In the years since the bombing, Amy became a mother, lost 200 pounds, competed in an Ironman triathlon, obtained her MBA, and became the CEO of the same credit union that was bombed. Though an inspirational subject in national and local media for more than two decades, Amy's message has shifted from her survival of the bombing to her radical transformation in the aftermath. Amy lives in Oklahoma City and is a frequent speaker across the country. Welcome, Amy.
I am so thrilled to be here and to join you in conversation today.
Oh, so like, why don't we just fill in some of the gaps of this bio? Why don't you just take us through your story and how this journey all began?
You bet. So, you know, can we go back to like 1988 for a minute? 1988, I had amazing hair. I had really big hair. I don't know if you remember that decade, but that was like the bangs, you know, that would reach out and grab you, like huge hair.
And I do. I had huge hair at that time, yeah, too.
and mine was awesome. I just got to say, I had great hair. And that was about the only thing I had going for me, because I had flunked out of college because I couldn't pass the remedial math class. Not the actual math class you get credit hours for, but the remedial one you have to pass before you can even take that one. So I was floundering, did not know what I wanted to do with my life, and thought with my amazing math skills that I should get a job as a teller. So I had a cash drawer. It's kind of scary. And worked for a financial institution in downtown Oklahoma City in the Murrah Building. And that was sort of the beginning of my career. I didn't know it. I thought I just needed a job to pay bills. So, mm-hmm. You know, I got this job, you know, at this credit union as a teller, and somehow I fell in love with the whole idea of what a credit union was all about, which is where I worked. And the women, what was really cool was this organization was all women. And I was very fortunate to have some of them mentor me and just teach me. And that just really began a journey for me that I'm getting ready to turn 54 years old. So, of course, the 1988 you know, probably gave it away, but I'm older. But, you know, it has been a journey to get to a place. I love your tagline of working from a happy place. And I can honestly say I'm working from a happy place, but it didn't start out that way. So, yeah, and in the bombing was a critical moment, defining moment in my life that really changed everything. Because up until that moment, I had been pretty complacent, you know, kind of floating through life. I mean, I had these amazing women at work, you know, mentoring me, but I really, you know, wasn't living my life on purpose you know, really doing anything with my life other than just floating, you know, kind of from day to day. And when the bombing happened, that was sort of the moment that changed everything for me.
So for a lot of our listeners, they may not remember that, or they might be of an age where they just don't, they didn't see it in the news. They don't have a real recollection of it or know any details about it. Right. So if you don't mind, I know it's probably a pretty intense story to continue to relive, but can you take us back to that day and what transpired, and then ultimately how that did transform your life?
Right. So, this financial institution that was in the federal building in downtown Oklahoma City was 9 stories tall. I worked on the 3rd floor, very close to the front glass windows. On April 19th, 1995, what started out as a normal spring morning at work turned into the deadliest act of domestic terrorism the United States has ever seen. And this was when a terrorist lit a bomb in a truck in front of the building, killed 168 people. I was sitting at my desk that morning and had no idea what was getting ready to happen. One of my coworkers came and sat down right beside me to ask me a question. And I turned to ask her what she needed. And I don't know if the words even came out of my mouth or not, because that's when the bomb went off. And I remember just hearing this incredible roaring in my head and feeling this powerful sensation like I was falling. And I was falling 3 floors.
Wow.
I found out later I had fallen 3 floors. I was actually still in my desk chair, but upside down and buried under about 10 feet of rubble. But it all happened so fast. All I knew was there is this loud noise. I could hear people screaming. I remember hearing this woman screaming right in my ear, and then me realizing that was me. That was my voice. And I was just so terrified. I didn't even recognize the sound of my own voice. And I remember laying there, you know, I really didn't know where I was. I didn't know what had happened.
Mm-hmm.
Everything was black. I remember, you know, trying to open my eyes to see, and everything was just black. And I could hear, you know, all this screaming, but then the screaming stopped. And I begin yelling, "Help me, help me, you know, someone help me." And there was nothing, no reply. And it was about 45 minutes before I heard men's voices, and they were looking for, there was a daycare in the building, and they were looking for the daycare babies. I could hear them talking. So I started screaming my head off, you know, and I heard one of the men say, I hear you, child, how old are you?" And I'm thinking, "I'm 2, you know, I was afraid if I told them I was 28, they weren't going to come get me. And they started trying to find me, but they couldn't see me. So they had to follow the sound of my voice. And eventually they got to me and they uncovered my right hand. And I remember feeling someone's hand on mine, thinking, you know, this is one of those moments, like 1, 2, 3, like pull me up and out and thinking I'm free. And about the time they grabbed my hand, I heard other men in the background yelling, "There's another bomb. There's another bomb. We got to go. Everybody, let's go. There's another bomb." And so at that time, that's when I realized, you know, what had happened and that I wasn't going to get out. And so I just began telling them my name and tell my family I love them, because I knew, you know, this was it. And my rescuers left and I was alone and began experiencing what a lot of people, you know, refer to as life flashing before your eyes.
Mm-hmm.
And just all of a sudden realizing everything, you know, that maybe I thought was important before really wasn't. And, you know, all of a sudden what really mattered was relationships. And, you know, for me, you know, what was going to happen next, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so it was a very, I had deep regret. I had terrible regret. And I think that was more terrifying to me than anything, was the thought that I'm getting ready to die and I never really lived. And so
that's pretty powerful. I mean, mm-hmm. That's a super powerful feeling.
It really is. And I, you know, I since read a book by Bronnie Ware about the regrets of the dying. She was a hospice nurse that, you know, was with, you know, a lot of dying patients and found out through her experience that the number one regret of the dying was not living a life true to themselves. And for me, you know, that I really get that. It's that regret of how you lived. And, you know, I think that's really important. And I think, you know, I just so admire entrepreneurs who are following their passion and taking that risk to go out and do the thing, right? Because mm-hmm. they're not going to have that regret because they did it. They took the chance. They lived a life true to themselves. I was not in that place. And I started bargaining with God. I just started begging, you know, I just want a second chance. And I just want a do-over, you know, just a do-over. And I remember, you know, just of all the weird things to do, I actually started singing. And I'm not a singer. Don't worry. I'm not going to break out in song for you. But I started singing this song. And when I did, I felt peace. And I knew, I felt I was going to be okay. I didn't know they were going to come back and get me. I really thought, you know, I was getting ready to die. But I was at peace with that.
Wow.
And, of course, there was not a second bomb. That's why I'm here today. And they came back and began working to get me out. It took them 6.5 hours to free me.
Oh my gosh. But that's what I was getting ready to ask you, because I remember hearing that before when I had heard you on another podcast. And I just thought, 6.5 hours, like,
yes.
Think about that. So for somebody that is thinking, think about what I did instantly when I heard that, is I think about how long it takes me to drive to my cousin's house in Kentucky. And for me, that's it, almost exactly 6.5 hours. That's a,
oh my gosh,
that's a day trip. You know what I mean?
Yes.
I mean, that's like me making a big plan and getting ready and getting in the right. car and driving and stopping and having to eat. And like, I really put that into perspective of that trip. And what do I do? I have to go to the bathroom. I have to stop and get something to eat. And then I finally get there and I'm pretty exhausted. And that's just from driving in the car for straight 6.5 hours. And so I totally, for me, that's what I put into perspective when I was listening to that and thinking that I would be buried under rubble for 6.5 hours.
Wow. And I never thought about it like that. But, you know, I'm a person who, I can't stand a car ride for more than 4 hours. And so, yeah, it was a long time. And I remember at one point, you know, they were talking about amputating my leg, because I was, this whole time, I was upside down in this rubble pile. So this entire time, I never could see anything or move. And
but you could breathe. That was the thing I was sitting there wondering about, that I didn't hear you say. So how were you able to breathe in that?
It was extremely hard to breathe, very hard to breathe. I would just felt like I would have to lift my head up a little bit. I had a little bit of wiggle room with my head. Mm. And I would have to sort of turn my head to try to just get air. It was very difficult. But later in the day, they thought there was another bomb again. But my rescuers knew there wasn't one. But they were being forced to leave. And so they said, you know, what can we get you? And I said, well, it's really hard to breathe and I'm thirsty. And so they got an oxygen tube all the way down in the hole so that I could breathe easier. And then they put a wet rag on a stick and put it down there so I could, you know, suck the water out of the rag so I could get something to drink.
Wow.
And, yeah. So it was, you know, and I remember I would hear them talk about amputating my leg. And I said, you know, it's amazing, like the strength you have when you have to have it. So, because I am such like, I don't even like, I freak out with a shot. Like I'm such a baby, but I said to them, I said, if you need to chop something off to get me out, chop it off. And I mean, that sounds really crude, but like, I meant it. Like I wanted to live. And I was like, whatever you have to do, do it. And they just kept saying to the emergency physician that was going to do the amputation, I could hear them say, give us 20 more minutes, give us 20 more minutes. Because the issue was the area of the building where I was extremely unstable and could fall. And so all of these men were risking their lives working to get me out in an area that was later they had to implode the building to get the remaining bodies out that were located there because it just wasn't safe for them to be there.
Wow.
So I'm extremely fortunate that these men risked their lives all day long to get me out.
Wow. So you're free. You finally you're out. The rubble's off of you and you can see probably light and you see their faces. Like what was the feeling that you had in that moment?
When they counted to three and they pulled me out and I looked around for the first time, I could not believe the destruction. Mm. I could not believe my own eyes. I really couldn't. I don't remember seeing their faces, and probably because at this point I was completely stiff and could barely move. So all I could really see was sort of to the side a little bit. And I just remember thinking, this isn't real. This is not real. And then looking at the sky and thinking, you know, this is so weird because the morning was like this bright blue spring sky. And later in the day, it turned very cold and gray, like the middle of winter. Mm-hmm. And I remember thinking, it feels like winter. But taking that first breath of fresh air and promising God, I will never live my life the same. And they took me to an ambulance. And then that's when I fell apart because they were going to give me a shot, a tetanus shot. And I lost it. I'm bawling, crying. I don't want a tetanus shot. You know, it's crazy.
Crazy. But you know what? When you're like in this sort of weird emotional state, it's like suddenly now you're yeah. alive and you've been able to get through this. And it's like, no, don't give
now
me a tetanus shot.
Yeah. So, but they took me to the hospital. I was in the hospital about 8 days. And while I was in the hospital, I found out one by one that 18 of my 33 coworkers, these wonderful women, were killed, including my mentor, including my best work friend, and the girl I was sitting next to that was waiting to talk to me. And it was just, a very dark, very dark, very traumatic time, obviously. And, you know, I'd like to say, like, you know, I got out of the hospital, like, cue the Rocky music. I went running out of the hospital to go change my life, you know, but it didn't exactly work that way. I had a lot of difficulty just kind of working through the grief and the trauma. The other thing was, so now that we had lost over half of our staff of these incredible women, the handful of us that were left did not want this financial institution, this little credit union to go away, to be destroyed in it. And so we lost our only location. We lost our business model. We lost over half our staff. there's a handful of traumatized employees, and we're trying to figure out how to keep from being merged, how to keep from, you know, how do we, because it felt like if we could keep this credit union alive, we were somehow keeping the memories of those we loved alive. So it became very personal.
Wow.
All of a sudden it went from a job to something like, I mean, I feel it's weird in some ways. I feel like an entrepreneur because I feel like it's my company, even though it's actually not. It just, I feel that way though. It's very deeply personal.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, so we had a lot of work to do, but the process of working through something that massive and learning how to, you know, set an action plan, you know, mm-hmm. and take those steps. And it taught me so much that I was able to turn around and take that and apply it to my personal life. Because I remember one day thinking, man, you know, I'm amazing at work. My personal life is a mess, but I'm really great at work. How can that translate? Like, how come I can't translate what I'm doing over here to my personal life? And then I thought, well, why can't I? And I took out an index card and wrote the first thing that was important to me that I wanted to do on that index card, which was actually was go back to school. I kind of wanted to, it bothered me that that was that failure in my life. I just needed personally to do it, you know? Mm-hmm. And that was my first thing I wrote. And I wrote the first action steps, the smallest steps I could take, I wrote on there. And that was the beginning of something being set in motion that began, you know, little by little, the smallest steps over time began changing my life.
So I have a question with that. So first of all, so you're having to really put a lot of energy into figuring out how to save this credit union. And so just give us just a couple of things. Like, did you go find a new location straight away? Is that one of the first things you did? What was some of your first steps that you did to save this? Because it's a handful of you that are trying to do this. So what were a couple of steps that you took there? And then I have one more question for you.
Sure. Well, so this was in 1995. So, you know, working from home, I didn't have a little laptop, but they brought me a giant monitor because I was still really injured. And I worked from home with like a giant monitor and everything. one of the things that was really great is that my industry, credit unions, are very collaborative. So credit unions came together to help us. So there was an amazing, good people coming forward to help us. So that was a huge benefit. We had a really large credit union in town that had a sort of a mock teller training where they mm-hmm. would train their tellers. They literally said, just come take over this and you can work out of our office. So we opened up 48 hours later, but in a competitor's office. So,
wow.
I mean, that's crazy, but that's what people did, you know? And so we had help, but, then we had to really figure out what we're going to do. So yes, we had to find a location mm-hmm. and here's the thing from a business model, our previous location was free. We didn't pay anything. We were there to serve those federal employees. So we didn't pay anything.
Gotcha.
So we now suddenly went from free space to we have to now pay for space. So it really changed a lot for us. And then we had to figure out, we ended up having to change from serving federal employees to serving the community. There was just so many things that we had to start changing and hiring all new staff. And we hired so quickly because we just needed people that we found ourselves about a year later, 2 years later, with a very unhealthy organization. You know, we had personalities that, you know, we couldn't put a lot of thought into it. It was just kind of like, hey, if you need a job, we're going to hire you. And then mm-hmm. later it's like, oh, wow, we've really got this kind of mess here. Mm-hmm. And I remember my boss, the CEO that they hired to come in and help in the aftermath, she asked me this magic wand question, you know, if you had a magic wand, what would you fix here? And that was one of the things I said to her was, you know, the culture, you know, it would be a place where people enjoyed coming. Like we would be like family. It would be, you know, I had this whole idea mm-hmm. and she said, okay, given your current situation and your current limitations, what are the smallest steps you can do to make that happen? And that was so powerful to me because I could not be a victim. Because she said, given your current situation and your current limitations, what can you do? So there was no way to hide behind anything because she already addressed that by saying, okay, given all those things, what can you do? And I was like, wow, you know, and I made this list of the things that I could do, which were very small. I was not in management yet. I mean, it was literally like smile, you know, be friendly to people, like, I mean, to start trying to change a culture, you know? Mm-hmm. And I am so proud of our organization because for 5 years in a row, we have now been voted a best place to work in Oklahoma City. And knowing where we came from and how dysfunctional it was to where mm-hmm. it is now, it is really, really cool for me to see.
Oh, gosh, I bet. So my second question to you for people listening here. So you're injured. You've gone through a devastating situation. You're dealing with grief, no doubt, mm-hmm. for all the things that happened. And you decide you're going to go, and you've got to try to transform this, save this credit union, all of you together. And then you decide to go back to school full time, which is a huge undertaking, a huge. Mm-hmm. So how did you, and for some people, that's so huge that they're saying to themselves, well, that's impossible. Like, no, I can't do that. So, but you did do it. And so how did you do that?
So what I did is I broke it down to the very smallest step I could take. So my first step was to find the phone number to LSU. Second step was get my transcript. Third one was to go on the internet and try to find a college that would take someone with a 0.50 grade point average, a college that was actually accredited, you know, a college that would take me.
Wow.
And then take a class, like a class. Mm-hmm. So it started out so, so small, like just take a class and then finish that class and then take another class. And that's what I did until I got a handful of credit hours. And then I found a college that had, which now these are of course very common now, but find a college that had an adult studies program because those are geared toward working adults. So they're usually, you know, one night a week. They're, you know, a lot of work outside the classroom, but really you only have to go that one night. And at this point I had a small child. And so it was important to me. I'm trying to balance all of this, you know, mm-hmm. home, work, school. I look back now and I think, wow, that was really overwhelming. But I think I just did it in such small steps along the way that it didn't seem too overwhelming. I mean, I think there were moments, yes, where, you know, I probably had a big project mm-hmm. due and it felt overwhelming. But
right. You know. Somebody said to me recently, because basically due to COVID, I've had to change the whole model of my business. And I've worked harder probably in this last year than I have in the last 10, if I'm being mm-hmm. as honest as I can be. And someone said to me the other day, how in the world are you doing what you're doing? I don't know how you do what you do. And I said, I don't stop and think about what I do.
Mm-hmm.
That's how I'm doing what I'm doing. I wake up each day. And I don't even look at the whole day. If I got up in the morning and said, oh my goodness, my day starts at 9. It's not ending till 10 o'clock tonight. I'm either speaking or I'm got meetings or mm-hmm. I'm doing something. If I did that, I would be depressed all day. So I'm just like, okay, here's my 9 o'clock meeting. What am I going to accomplish in it today?
Right. You know, and don't you think there's like a, I don't know, it's kind of like a, You adjust, right? Like mm-hmm. whatever you have on your plate, you just figure it out.
Agreed.
It's just hard to explain, but it does. It's kind of like, I remember when I was really young, my older sister said to me, you know, when it came to money, she said, you know, your money will just, it seems like whatever you have, you just make work. And it seems to be the same with your time. I mean, now you have to be intentional and you have to schedule, mm-hmm. but you know, I mean, that's important, right? You got to schedule. And I think when you have a lot on your plate, you're probably better at scheduling. right? Because you know you have to. So you 100%. Get really efficient, you know?
Absolutely. All right. So you decide to go back to school. You end up getting a degree. And then you continue on. You got your master's as well, did you not?
I did. So somewhere in that process, I all of a sudden started thinking, I wonder if I could be a CEO one day. Like, I wonder if that's possible. And my mentor, the CEO at work, told me, she said, listen, the days are gone where you can become a CEO. You know, you need a master's, you know, and you don't have to have a master's, but if you really want to make sure that, you know, back then there were still quite a few, you know, it was a male dominated mm-hmm. sort of industry. And so the way we looked at it is I need to have even more on my resume than maybe a man would have if I'm going to be considered. You still sort of felt like you were at a disadvantage. So I thought I'm going to get my master's. And I started getting so much confidence with, wow, I actually did something for me and I did it. You know, there was momentum that came with that. So then I started thinking about, you know, my weight really bothered me. I was 200 pounds overweight. And I thought, well, maybe, you know, maybe I could try again, you know, because I would try all kinds of things. And so I started using the research that I had learned. You know, I learned a lot about research in, you know, having to write college papers. And so I started researching different ways that people were losing weight, because I thought, you know, the definition of insanity is trying the same thing over and over again. So, mm-hmm. okay, fine. Let's just have an open mind and let's look at everything available and just try different things. And so I ended up doing a bariatric surgery called a gastric sleeve. And, you know, at first it was very successful. I lost quite a bit of weight, like they told me I would the first year. The doctor had warned me, if you don't change your life, if you don't exercise, the weight will stop coming off and you will gain it back. And sure enough, about a year after that surgery, the weight stopped coming off. And every time I went for my checkup, they would ask me what I was doing to, you know, exercise. And I would always tell them I was walking, because I justified that I wasn't lying, because I would have to walk from my car across the parking lot to the appointment. So I was technically walking, but really I had not quite changed my life there yet. So at that point I realized, okay, there's no magic pill or surgery. Like, I really am going to have to do the work here. And so I started going to a gym, and I started getting up in the morning, going to a gym. And then I got a bicycle and I started riding a bike. And it was just one thing after it, just small, like leveling up. And before I knew it, you know, I was riding my bicycle across the state of Oklahoma in the summertime for a week-long vacation. And I've done that every year for 10 years now. And then I started running and then started swimming. And then, you know, that led to doing an Ironman triathlon.
Wow. It's amazing. But I want to take all of our like listeners back to, it is just the small steps in creating new habit patterns. Mm-hmm. And then for even people that are listening to this, they may never want to do a triathlon. Like, I personally don't ever want to do a triathlon, but I have started biking, and I did a 70-mile trip this fall with my husband on one weekend. So for a Saturday and Sunday, we did the 70-mile bike ride. And then I heard you say that on the podcast, and we had already started saying, what can we do this year? Like, as we get into bike season, what would be a fun route to do? Or what would be, you know, to stretch ourselves just a little bit more and to push ourselves? Because I know how I felt when I finished that. So it's just creating new habit patterns and then stretching yourself a little bit along the way. And people don't have to just say, oh, I haven't ever exercised, so I'm going to get in shape and try to do a triathlon. And that's where I think people get hung up in their minds.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I never once dreamed of anything big or crazy. It literally was the smallest thing. I wanted to just ride a bike for about 15 minutes in my neighborhood. And then I remember I thought, I bet if I rode my bike, my son was riding with me. And so I was like, he wanted to get a snow cone or icy. And so I was like, I bet we could ride to this little gas station that has ices, and that would get us some exercise and he could get an icy. And I mean, that was like maybe a 5 minute route, you know? Mm-hmm. So it was like so small. And then we had a lake that had, I found out, had a bike path, which, mm-hmm. okay, I was so not somebody that exercised that when I found out there was a bike path around a lake, and I went to it for the first time and I saw all these people like out running and skateboarding and riding bikes. I told my sister, I was like, I had no idea there was like a secret society in here. I had no clue. Like I had no idea there is this bike path. This is crazy. And it was 9 miles. And when I rode my bike 9 miles around that thing, I was like, where is my dadgum medal? Like I'm freaking mm-hmm. Lance Armstrong. I am amazing. Like I won a medal. That's how huge that 9 miles was to me. And I never would have dreamed that I could have ridden my bike, you know, 50 or 70 or 112 ever.
Right. That's awesome. It's so awesome. And it is like a secret society. I walk on this trail that is, they're all old. And almost every state has them, so people can look it up. But there's like rails to trails. So they've taken old railroad trails and then made these into bike paths or walking paths. And most cities kind of have them and or towns. And that's what I walk on. And then I started riding on that. And I'm getting even more adventurous. But when I just went out the other day, because we've got some nice weather here, I was like, they were all out. They're all out. Mm-hmm. The secret society is all out. And it's like, there they are. And you start to see some of the same people and you're almost like, hey, and everybody's nice. And yes. It's just the most awesome thing. I feel so alive when I'm on that. And when I see yes. other people that are doing the same thing. And like I was walking and one lady said, right up above, there's a pretty, really rough icy patch. So be careful. I'm like, oh, thanks. It's just that kind of community. So people really need to find a community like that yes. if they can.
Yes.
All right. So now you've gone back to school and you're furthering your career at the credit union. You're losing some weight and starting to get into shape. At what point do you become the CEO of the institute that you barely could get a teller job at?
So I became CEO in December of 2017. So I feel like I have been the CEO for 10 years because 1 year has been a COVID year. So mm-hmm. I feel like, you know, in calling dog years, you know, if yeah. you've led an organization over the past year, yeah, that's like 5 years. But yeah. So 2017 was really epic for me because I turned 50 and I wanted to do something epic. So that is when I did the Ironman. And then that same year, in fact, it was right after I completed the Ironman in November. And in December, I was placed as CEO.
That had to be such an incredible feeling. Mm-hmm. Like, what did you feel that day when you were named CEO of that institution? What was the feelings that went through you on that day?
So I got to share how it happened. This is really
okay.
Cool.
I love good okay. stories.
So I so believe in mentoring because I was mentored. My boss, who's this amazing woman, had mentored me and she had taught me this exercise about, you know, designing your future self by allowing yourself to dream, by asking things like if I had a magic wand or whatever, and really writing down as if it had already happened what you want future self to be, right? So I had shared with her, you know, of course, obviously, because she was mentoring me, I'd shared with her where I had written, I'm CEO of the credit union. You know, I wrote it like it really happened. And this was years before. She shared in a staff meeting with the whole staff, she shared this exercise in a staff meeting. Like, I want to tell you how powerful this is. You know, write it down, the things that you want. You have to live intentionally, you know, write it down. And she said, I'll give you an example. Amy, come up here. I want you to write two things on the board that future you is going to be. And so I wrote down, I've ridden my bike across the United States was one. And she said, okay, write another one. And so I wrote, you know, I am CEO of Allegiance Credit Union. And then she said, I want everybody to know this one just came true. She is the next CEO of Allegiance Credit Union. And oh my gosh, I mean, I just, you know, the tears. And it was awesome because this was a woman that had faith in me and saw something in me before I even saw it in myself. And it was because of her and her mentorship that I even had the opportunity. So it was very special.
I love that. And one of the things that I always try to encourage people is in your life, you should always be a mentor to somebody and being mentored by somebody.
Yes.
Like, you never get past that, really. And if you have, then you're kind of missing out.
Yeah.
You're missing out on the two best things, because we can all still grow and have another mentor and learn new things or different things, but we should then be paying it forward and being mentoring somebody. And yes, in anybody's life, no matter where you are, and this is what I try to share with them, is stop and just think, okay, who can I get mentored by and who could I mentor? Because if you can live in that space of being a mentor and being mentored, it's like, it's amazing. It's an incredible space to be in.
Truly. And I think a lot of people miss out on still being mentored once they become successful in business, because they think, oh, well, I've arrived. I'm already the CEO. I'm this. I don't need a mentor anymore. They may believe in mentoring others, but I disagree. I think you should still be looking for someone to mentor you, no matter what you've achieved. There is still more to grow and learn from someone else.
Okay, so we've spent a good little time, and I still have a couple things I really want to talk about. So the next, like, four questions I'm going to give you, I want you, instead of being super thoughtful, just be like they're like a speed round, okay?
All right.
All right, awesome. So superpowers, what are some of your greatest skill sets that have helped you continue to be successful?
Flexing my personality to others. For communication, knowing how to communicate with other personalities.
Okay.
And along those same lines, I think it's asking clarifying questions. I've learned how to do that. I think that's been really helpful skill.
I think that's a powerful skill. We were just talking about that in our office, is that good communication is about asking good questions and then making sure that there wasn't a miscommunication so that you get clarity about what it is you're actually supposed to do.
Yes.
Awesome. One of your most outstanding accomplishments that's super meaningful for you.
Easy. Ironman Arizona 2017, 2.4 mile swim, followed by 112 mile bike ride, followed by a 26.2 marathon, all within 17 hours to be declared an Ironman.
Oh my gosh, I can't even imagine. Like, seriously, that's why I said that's not on my bucket list. Wow, congratulations. That's an awesome accomplishment. All right. Biggest challenge or obstacle that you faced?
I've had a lot, obviously, with the bombing. That's a big one. But another big one was facing burnout. I faced burnout in 2012 and just... that was really difficult. Just kind of going through the motions, being complacent, knowing I didn't want to be complacent. What do I do? And I reached out to some other leaders in my industry. One of them suggested I attend a particular conference. So I did. And thank God it worked. I came back energized and kind of got the shot in the arm I needed.
That's awesome. And I know for a lot of people, job burnout is real. And I think a lot of people don't really address it or then say, what can I do? So that's awesome. And sometimes it can be something as simple as going to a conference, and it's really about being inspired. I think that It's learning to dream again or be inspired again or to reach. One of the things I loved so much that you said about dreaming is that, and I heard that on your podcast, and I'd already been thinking about dreaming. And I also had another gal on my podcast who said her greatest power or superpower was that she always dreams big and that those dreams have come to pass. But this gal's just like 32, right? Mm-hmm. And it hit me because I just turned 60 this year, earlier, a couple months ago. And I was like, I've quit dreaming that big. I used to be that big dreamer in my 20s, my 30s, even in my 40s. It's like, what happened to you? Mm-hmm. And then I heard your podcast. It was like this, like all happened at the same time. And so I have a 98-year-old uncle that is just this last year said, I'm thinking about buying a boat. You know, would you like to go fishing? I mean, like, and I thought he has not quit dreaming. He is dreaming about getting a boat and going fishing every day. And I think that's what's contributed to his really long lifestyle. So you touched on this about dreaming and about your mentor really pushing you to do that. So, and I know this is going to lead us into where I want to go, which is talking about your book. But can you just elaborate on that a little bit? Because I think it's so huge. I feel like COVID has really squashed everybody's dreams. They've become paralyzed.
Yes.
And they have not allowed themselves to dream about anything.
Right. It has. It has just been crippling. And I think now is the time that we need to start dreaming again. And if you need help, it can start so simple, just like my mentor told me, if you had a magic wand. And let yourself really think about that and sit in that for a minute. If you had a magic wand, and then the next question, given your current situation and your current limitations, what are the smallest steps you can take? Because what that is you're giving yourself hope. When you think about it, when you have agency, when you have a pathway and control over getting there, even if it may be a little difficult or outside of your comfort zone, you know, if you have said, you've identified, okay, I want to, like in my case, I want to ride a bicycle. Okay. And then I make my steps. I'm going to go visit a bicycle store. I'm going to buy a bicycle. I'm going to ride it for 5 minutes. Like you set those easiest, so simple steps up that you can't mess it up. Like, you know, you walk away feeling hopeful because you can suddenly see that you have now painted a better picture of your future and you actually play a role in making it happen. So you've got this better, brighter future and you're the one that's actually going to take steps to make this thing happen. You just gave yourself hope.
Wow. That's awesome. We're going to do two more quick ones, and then I want you to talk about your book, okay? This is our signature question of the show. What does working from your happy place mean to you?
For me, working from my happy place is when I'm working from my strengths. I've really been trying to focus on that this past year, because when I'm not working from my strengths, I find myself being depleted. You know, it zaps my energy. Whereas if I'm working inside my strengths, that energizes me and I feel good. Like it doesn't feel like work. It's fun. So I want to work from my strengths. One of my top strengths is ideation. And whenever I'm in that place where they need my ideation at work and it doesn't even feel like work. I love it.
Oh, I love that. And what advice would you give to others wanting to be entrepreneurs?
Resist complacency. Because whether you start your own business or whether you are working for a business, at some point along the way, the natural tendency is to drift toward complacency. So you have to fight against that and you have to continue to keep a growth mindset. Whatever it is you need to do to keep yourself excited and growing, you've got to do that and resist that complacency, because at some point that starts entering in.
Wow, so true. When you said that, I'm a real visual person, so I like to try to create immediate pictures. And so an analogy that I can hang on to, and when you said that, I thought, yeah, that's so true. I immediately thought of either swimming against the current or being in a kayak and trying to row against that or paddle against that current, because the natural tendency is for your boat or you to go with the current. And then you just, you got to kind of go against it sometimes.
And you drift. At that point, you're drifting.
You absolutely are drifting. If anybody's ever, you know, done that, in which you've been a swimmer, and I like being in my kayak, but it's just like, it just takes you and you go. And you kind of long for the ride versus like really creating the ride. You know what I mean?
Right.
Yeah, I love that. All right. So let's talk about, I know some new and exciting things you're working on, or you just released your book. Tell us about your book.
Oh, so I released a book called Hope is a Verb. And it is about my story of what I would have thought was impossible transformation. If you would have told me that I went from teller to CEO, from 355 pounds to an Ironman, if you would have told me all these things 26 years ago, I would have not believed you. It would just be that crazy. And so I wrote about this journey and about going through the bombing and all of this. And my hope is that other people will read this and feel inspired, because I feel like if I could get my act together so late in life, and if I could accomplish what I've been able to accomplish, then other people could even do so much more, because I feel like I was almost at a disadvantage because of how late I was in life at so much. But I just want people to know that despite what's happened to you, no matter what you've been through, don't stop dreaming and don't stop looking at the steps you can take to make your future better and brighter, because you can't, there is something you can do. And once you start doing that, it gives you hope and it can change. It changes your life for the better. So, I released the book exactly a year ago and COVID hit.
Wow.
So I've been kind of on a tour promoting it, because I think now it's funny. I didn't write it about COVID. I didn't know anything about COVID, but now I look at it and I'm like, wow, this actually is a message that's really relevant right now.
Wow, what perfect timing. You know, you can look at it and go, wow, it came out right then. But then for a lot of people that, For everyone, I'm not going to say for a lot of people, because it's been different for everyone, but every single person has faced some kind of challenge, and it's a very personal one for them in this past year that they've had to work through. And having something like that is so important. Something else you said earlier that I just want to point out as a little nugget, because people miss it. And I've said this forever, is like, if you're going to really work with people or coach people or mentor people, however you want to word it, it's like people need to know that somebody else believes in them. And you said that about your mentor, knowing that she believed in you. Oftentimes, we don't rise to the occasion until we know someone else believes in us.
That's right.
And it is so important that we're letting other people know, like, I believe in you. You can do this. And that's probably one of the most important things. I tell people, you can teach people stuff all day long, but if you're an encourager and you let people know that you believe in them, they'll actually rise to the occasion 10 times quicker than all the knowledge you've just imparted with them.
Absolutely. That's how I felt. You know, she believed in me. I didn't want to let her down. So I worked so hard because I did not want to let her down, because she believed in me.
Mm-hmm. Gosh, Amy, I've loved this interview. I knew I was going to before I had it, and it has not disappointed. So I just want to say thank you so much. And I just want to thank you for sharing your story. I think it's brave to share that story, because it's a painful one. And I think it's incredible that you actually, in that moment, I think many of us know we've been in those moments where you start making deals, right?
Yeah.
But then sometimes that passes and people don't change anything in that deal, or they don't live up to their deal.
Right.
And I'm so inspired that you did. But I also need people to understand that wasn't overnight. It wasn't overnight. It's a journey.
Yes.
And you can take it by doing one tiny step at a time.
Yes.
And you've shown that so well and eloquently to our listeners and to everyone through just living your life and then through your books and then your speaking engagements. So I just want to thank you for doing that, for following your heart and following that, you know, the deals you made in those moments and taking one of the most horrific situations that could have ever happened to anyone and actually doing something with that can now inspire others and move them to reach their full potential as well. So thank you.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it. It's been great.
So where can people find you and where can they find your book?
The book is on Amazon, Hope is a Verb. And you can find me, the easiest way is amydowns.org on my website, amydowns.org.
Perfect. Well, gosh, what a great interview, everyone. And I hope that you enjoyed it as much as I did. And I encourage you to go grab her book. And I encourage you to subscribe to our podcast because we have these amazing interviews. And if you subscribe, you won't miss a single one. So again, thanks to our guest, Amy, and thanks to all of you for listening. And until next time on Work From Your Happy Place.
Thanks for joining us at Work From Your Happy Place. If you like what you hear, please share it with your friends and be sure to rate and review us on iTunes or Stitcher. For a free gift on finding your own happy place, please visit workfromyourhappyplace.com and click on the free audio button. Thanks again for listening.